RadioInfluence.com.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Tennis with an Accent, brought to you in partnership with RadioInfluence.com. This is Saqib, and once again, joined by Matt Zemek, who's back now in Phoenix. And we are doing this podcast late Sunday evening, East Coast time, and it's early evening for Matt. So let me welcome Matt back to the podcast after a hiatus of like 4 weeks. Hey, Matt, how are things? Hey.
Things are going good, and it's good to be back on the podcast. Thanks for holding it down the last few weeks.
Not an issue at all. You've been holding on the digital form so I can, you know, carry on my responsibilities behind the microphone. Plenty to talk about. A big weekend of tennis unfolded. Let's start with the big action in Singapore. This was the last edition of the WTA Finals. We all know it's going to be moving to China for the next edition, but this was some eventful weekend of tennis and week of tennis. Did you see the result coming? Because I did not see Svitolina, going undefeated.
Not at all, Saqib. And, you know, this is really the continuing story of the WTA Finals. In 2015, Agnieszka Radwańska won it all. In 2016, Dominika Cibulkova won it all. Last year, Caroline Wozniacki won it, and she did not have a major title at the time. She won her major a few months later in Australia, and now we have Elena Svitolina. So that's four straight years in which the WTA Finals champion did not own a major title at the time of her victory. And we also have a number of other patterns that emerge from this. Four out of 5 years at the WTA Finals, we've had the eighth and last seed, the lowest seed of the eight players in the field, get to the semifinals. And we have also seen a fourth straight year in which a player in the lower four seeds out of the eight won the title. Radwańska, Cibulkova, Wozniacki, and now Svitolina, they were all seeded fifth or lower in the group of eight. So the WTA Finals, this is a paradise and a playground for unpredictability. And so all of those trends were reinforced in 2018. So
let me ask you, Matt. So this very astute observation on your point. So why do you think this trend is resurfacing only at this championship? You think players are tired and maybe some other players who are not ranked as high, of course, they're all like top eight, are coming in with some momentum, like Garcia did last year, did not finish the job. And Svitolina was coming in pretty much, you know, left for the dead because, you know, we discussed with Ed Salmon when he was here a few weeks ago previewing this tournament. So why do you think this kind of tennis is taking place? Why the favorites aren't finishing the job at the finals?
Well, you know, as if you have, I'm talking really more to our listeners than to you, Saqib, but I mean, I'm obviously carrying this conversation on with you too. But really, for our listeners, if they've followed our podcast throughout the year, including, for example, our podcast with Andrew Burton before the U.S. Open, you know, Andrew made note of the WTA's search for not the next Serena, because there is no next Serena and there never will be a next Serena, but the WTA's search for, you know, a consistently strong player who takes command at the major tournaments each year. You know, maybe not someone who will win three major titles a year, but someone who will make, you know, two finals, three semis, four quarters, something like that. We're not seeing that kind of player on the WTA Tour. And that's not a deficit. That's not a problem. It is a function and product of the WTA's quality depth. You know, there are just so many really, really good players. It's widely acknowledged in the locker rooms and in the press rooms around the WTA Tour that, you know, there are just no easy first or second round matches anymore. I mean, not that many. And so it's hard to stack together excellent results time after time. And so the WTA finals in 2018, given the way that they worked out, were just a natural extension of the whole 2018 WTA season. Now, I think in a larger context beyond 2018, it is a little bit of the fatigue. It is a little bit of the major champions come to Singapore and don't have quite as much to prove. That doesn't mean that they were lacking hunger. I wrote at tennisaccent.com in our WTA finals coverage, I wrote about Svitolina. It wasn't that the rest of the field didn't care. It's just that she cared more. She had, clearly, I think we can all agree, an extra chip on the shoulder. She had more to prove than anybody else. And credit to her, she showed that. So there are some localized factors in 2018. There were some season-long factors. And yeah, there are also the general factors that are part of autumnal tennis. So it really was a mixture of several. So Saqib, let me ask you about Svitolina. You know, in our WTA Finals preview podcast, you had Ed Salmon, Fogmount, on Twitter, and you talked about Svitolina. And I distinctly recall that Ed, you know, expressed concern about Svitolina's health. You know, that what we were seeing on the surface might not have represented anything that her coach might have done. You know, that might have gone deeper than that. And then I don't think Ed was off base in voicing those concerns. I think a lot of people who follow women's tennis were concerned about Svitolina. So from that perspective, that backdrop, you know, what do you make of the week that Svitolina put together in Singapore and how it reshapes the conversation about her?
I think we've spoken at length, at least through different guests and different occasions, how Svitolina has been compared with Sasha Zverev on the women's side because she seems to be ready to make that next step, which is winning a major, which, you know, is a defining moment for, you know, most tennis champions. And she's just come short in those big tournaments, you know, either in the earlier rounds or she's been an early casualty. But her health and, you know, loss of weight and some of the other narratives followed her. I didn't really pinpoint myself what was the lopsidedness nature of her results. But like you said, she came in with extra purpose, extra motivation. And this is the field, you know, which really doesn't need extra motivation when you're competing with, you know, fellow champions. So now she's going to end the year as number four. No one saw that coming. And again, not to qualify to be talking about her state of mind, but a lot of time in sport, we've seen one partnership ends. And before the second partnership starts for a player, there's some sort of freedom of thought, or maybe the previous situation wasn't as bad. But she definitely came with, you know, very, you know, she probably hit a reset button somewhere, or she played more freely. I don't know what triggered here. Again, this is quite kind of unqualified opinion, but I've seen this kind of story a few times, you know, in my journey as a fan when I followed sport. A lot of times, you know, there's certain baggage with the coaching relationship, even in team sports. I've seen this in cricket, you know, and players start expressing themselves with more freedom. So maybe that's the case. But this is one venue to do it, and she did it. There were no easy matches. Like, you know, every match is pretty much a quarterfinal of a major. That's the kind of feel. That's the kind of company you're keeping in this last week of tennis. So Svitolina, definitely, if this is something what Caroline Wozniacki did last year, maybe, again, you know, the murmurs will start, can she win a major? And this is one way to sign off 2018, and she would be in the mix of things come Australia and even further, because we've seen glimpses that, you know, she can play tennis. It's not that she doesn't have the talent to do it. It's just only a matter of when, in my opinion. And this week really is going to, you know, set her, you know, in good shape for the 2019 season, unless you want to add something else. What did you see change in her game in this last week?
Well, you know, she took the initiative when she had to. And, you know, we know that the courts in Singapore are very slow, and we know that, you know, those conditions favored someone who plays the way Svitolina does, and they also favored the way Sloane Stephens plays. So from that standpoint, viewed through that prism, you know, it made sense that these were the two finalists. What did not make sense is that they had no momentum in and through the Asian swing in the weeks leading up to the tournament. But, you know, when we talk about what kind of players succeed or fail at the WTA finals, it's really very hit and miss. You know, it is not monolithic in terms of the in-form player or the player who, you know, has been rested because she hasn't been going deep in tournaments and then comes to Singapore fresh, you know, the track records there are not very consistent on one side of the divide. I mean, if you look at this tournament, you know, Kiki Bertens, you know, was an informed player and she did get to the semifinals. But then Stevens and Svitolina were not the informed players. So the final four really was a mixture. Karolina Pliskova also made the semifinals. You know, she did win Tokyo, wasn't tremendously impressive in China, but, you know, you could make the argument that she was at a place where she had enough rhythm to then come to Singapore and do well. So the four semifinalists represent a mixed bag. And so, you know, I'm reticent to draw any overly broad conclusions, but what is definitely known is that the conditions played into Svitolina's game, and Svitolina was able to use the court expertly. And so in terms of what this means for 2019, I think it definitely reinforces the notion that, you know, Roland Garros is going to be the pivot point for her year. I mean, it would be great if she won in Australia, but I don't think we should expect that because so many other players will be rested and ready for that tournament. But when you get into the clay grind, and Svitolina will be trying to go for a three-peat in Rome, having won there in Italy in 2017 and then this year as well. When we get to Paris for Roland Garros, that will be, I think, the tournament that will make or break Svitolina's year. If she wins there, then, you know, when you consider how slow the courts at the U.S. Open are, you know, you could see Svitolina putting together a two major year in Paris and New York. If she loses in Paris, though, you know, she's going to go to Wimbledon lacking confidence, which was exactly the scenario this year after she lost in the third round in Paris to Mihaela Buzărnescu. So I really think that, you know, winning on these slow hard courts, some people could say that they were kind of concrete clay. It reinforces the idea that, you know, Svitolina has rebuilt and reestablished herself as the person who's going to be at the forefront of the discussion when we get to Roland Garros next year.
And let's also talk about some of the other major winners. Of course, Halep didn't show up here because she was a last-minute withdrawal, but then we have Osaka and then Kerber and Wozniacki. So, Matt, again, not the kind of podcast we want to do here, but again, there were four different winners, and especially the top three women who were finished in the year in the rankings are Halep, Wozniacki, and Kerber, or Kerber and Wozniacki. So, which of the three, according to you, had the more impressive or of a tennis year? Because I know they all had their own battles. Halep and Wozniacki won their first major. It's unfair to ask that question, but just from a writer's point of view, which story did you fancy covering the most as it unfolded this year?
Well, when you ask me what was the best story to cover as a writer, that's a little bit more particular than, you know, who had the best or most impressive year. Let me deal with both of those. First, let's do the best, most impressive year. I think that, anyone who asked me on Twitter in the days leading up to the WTA finals asked me, you know, who's player of the year, because I wrote about Halep as being not necessarily the best player of the year, but the most important player of the year. And that's a piece that you can find in our archives at tennisaccent.com. But I did say to anyone who was willing to ask me or talk to me about it, I said that if Wozniacki won the WTA finals, she probably would be the player of the year. I didn't really address Kerber, but I think that if Kerber had won, it would have been the same thing. But since neither one of them won it, and more particularly since neither of them made the semifinals, and I know that Wozniacki had rheumatoid arthritis, you know, and that's something that should be taken into consideration. But nevertheless, the fact that the WTA finals results played out as they did, I think that leaves Halep as the player of the year. You know, she was 45-7 late in her Cincinnati stop. You know, she really put together the most consistent and complete year. And I think Kerber was close behind by making quarterfinals or better at each of the year's first three majors. Halep made at least 8 semifinals, if not 9, and made a few more quarterfinals. And, you know, through Cincinnati, Miami and Wimbledon were the only tournaments where she didn't at least get to the quarterfinals. So I think she had the most consistent season. I know that Wozniacki won a Premier Mandatory, whereas Halep just won a Premier 5 in Montreal. But nevertheless, I think at some point you have to account for the consistency of a season. And so the WTA Finals, by not crowning Kerber or Wozniacki, I think that does leave Halep as my choice for WTA Player of the Year. Now, in terms of the story that was the most favorite one to cover, well, I really enjoyed both. And this doesn't minimize what Kerber did. It also doesn't minimize what Naomi Osaka did at the U.S. Open. But first-time major winners, you know, at a midpoint or a later point in their careers, those are one of the best stories to cover in sports, especially if you cover tennis or golf. You know, the drama of a player wondering if he or she is ever going to break through, or if he or she is going to be remembered as, you know, in that onerous, oppressive label, the best player never to have won a major. You know, someone like Elena Dementieva or Dinara Safina, or from a few decades ago, recently inducted tennis Hall of Famer Helena Suková, to have never won that major title as a singles player. It is so oppressive, and the media, of course, asks that question so much for players who, you know, get to a very, very lofty place in the sport, but just haven't done that one thing. And I know that there's a temptation for us in the press to overvalue winning majors, but, you know, any great player, I think, does need that one stamp of approval. You know, you don't need to win 8 or 12 or 14 majors. You do need to win at least one if you want to be seen as a great player. So in both the cases of Halep and Wozniacki, those were immensely fun stories to write. And just being a human being, you know, we offer our takes on Twitter, and we offer our opinions and our analysis, and we're supposed to call it straight and play it right down the middle. But as a human being, your heart has to go out to these players who finally knock that door down and win a major. So Halep and Wozniacki were both tremendously great stories to write.
Very well said. I think definitely majors do define tennis greatness for most of us. And, you know, both these ladies, you know, getting over the hump, it was beautiful to see those stories unfold in each, you know, their own personal regard. Let's switch, you know, the conversation quickly here to the men's side, because the World Tour Finals in London, 2 weeks away, in the final tournament of the year, starts in Bercy tomorrow. But we are here today to discuss the wins in Vienna and Basel, a number 99 title for Roger Federer, and then Kevin Anderson keeps validating his big boy tennis. He's an excellent mover for his size. So pick a venue and let's talk about these wins and the men who lost the final to these guys today.
Well, let's start in Basel with Roger Federer winning title number 99, putting him 9 behind Jimmy Connors, 108. And in terms of open era match wins, Federer moved within 80 wins of Connors for number one on that list. So we're dealing with those countdowns for Federer. So he moved closer on both lists today with this win. And my main impression, Saqib, and I know that I'll want to hear your take on Federer, but my immediate reaction is Federer won Basel the way Novak Djokovic would often win a tournament. You know, recall the 2016 Australian Open in the fourth round when Djokovic committed 100 unforced errors. Who are we talking about? Of course, we're talking about Gilles Simon, you know, the guy who frustrates the top players, the guy who makes you hit ball after ball after ball, shrinks the court, you know, plays all that defense, consistently gets the ball back with depth, and just drives you crazy. And of course, so he did that to Djokovic 2.5 years ago in Melbourne, and he did that to Federer on Friday in Basel. And it really was not an average performance by Federer. It was a below average performance. And that followed the very shaky opening match against Filip Krajinovic. So it was very easy to think that heading into the semifinals against Daniil Medvedev, that Federer was going to get smoked. You know, Medvedev played Federer very evenly in Shanghai. That was 4-4 in the third. It was anybody's match. And Medvedev had just beaten Stefanos Tsitsipas in the Basel quarterfinals on Friday. Purely on form, purely on form, Medvedev was coming in there looking at the far better player. And I have to admit and acknowledge when I'm wrong, and I have to own up to this, that I said right after the Zverev, after Sasha Zverev lost to Mario Scopio in the first Basel semifinal on Saturday, I said, well, Medvedev is now the favorite to win Basel. And I got plenty of reaction, understandable, and moreover, I will say correct. And I was wrong to say that Medvedev was the favorite, but I was going on form, and Federer was able to dramatically turn around that equation. And while Medvedev, you know, couldn't keep his second serves in the court, he served a lot of double faults, several of them on break points, and it was an absolute beatdown, the last thing I expected. And that was not the first time that something happened that was completely unexpected to me, and it's certainly not going to be the last. But it, so it remains that Federer won the way Djokovic would often win a tournament, that he'd get through that one really ugly match. Djokovic has a history at past majors. I'm not really talking about 2018. I'm talking really more about his heyday in 2015 and early 2016. He would usually play a very scratchy semifinal, and then he'd go into destroyer mode in the final, often against Federer. So at this Basel tournament, Federer kind of put on the Djokovic mantle, you know, played a few very rough matches in the middle, but then in when he got to the weekend, he was very solid. You know, there were a few lapses in the final against Copil. His serve is still not airtight, but he played a very, very, very clean first set tiebreaker. It was a marked contrast with the first set tiebreaker against Borna Coric in Halle. So Federer really smoothed out his game in the big moments, and I think that's one of the more significant takeaways from his tournament in Basel.
I'd like to add, I think your comparison with Djokovic, Simon, is good, but that comparison only good for Gilles Simon, because I think in 2016, Djokovic really, you know, at least the first half of the player was playing lights out tennis, and that was like one, you know, strange match by his standards. But I think the more current example is how Djokovic was playing in Cincinnati. You know, he was there, he was not clinical, but by the time he got to the final, he produced his best game and then, of course, propelled him to win the U.S. Open. But I think Federer, I don't think was even today, I think he was good against Medvedev. I did not see the match, but I followed the score. So I think Federer was far from clinical, but it was good enough still to win a title at 500 level. His forehand definitely seemed to be, I think he would flatten out a little more today. I was reading and following some Twitter remarks, like how his forehand is not, the reliable shot that it was for at least for the last two tournaments, Shanghai included. I only saw the Struff match, and that too between meetings. And I wasn't really impressed with the forehand. But then again, this is Federer who, you know, in this field, you know, got it done. And I don't, you know, his age and all these things keep coming up. But what happens if he loses this tournament? Then, you know, then the knives are out. And now he wins this tournament, and it's kind of not a good feel. But, you know, like all these champion players, Djokovic included, Nadal included, you know, they all have, you know, days when they're not firing at their best, but it's the ability to win those weekends of tennis or those matches when they are not bringing their A game. And we don't know if Federer is playing, you know, with some sort of a niggle, but they all are deep in the season. It's a very physical sport. I think what's impressive is, you know, you don't get to 99 titles or what you know, 80 titles Nadal has or 72 titles Novak has or even Sampras before them. You know, this is just a testimony of, you know, a stellar career. And I'm not going to add anything, you know, new. This was ninth win, but I did make I think in one of those private DM chats, I did I was leaning towards that he was going to play Bercy, and that's the part of the conversation I want to bring you in. Of course, he won today and you know, played one of his better matches in the final for last 2 weeks. But going to Bercy, I think this point makes to me it's the right move. He's you know, he hasn't played as much tennis, even though he has a lot of obligation, like Nick Lester pointed out. And he has been only home, like, say, 5 days since he came to the States for the U.S. summer hard court swing. So he's a busy man. But I think tennis-wise, maybe I believe Bercy is the right move. Depending on how deep he goes, there's still like that 1 week off between Bercy and London. And maybe, you know, sometime we do underestimate. Look, we don't know like what his body is feeling. He's obviously reset the expectation for how 37-year-old body can play tennis. And Brady's doing this in football. And I'm sure LeBron's going to play. And then we'll see Novak, you know, who's going to play very well, you know, late into his mid-30s. So the bar of fitness has been raised. So we don't know exactly how these athletes are feeling because we form our own narrative after reading about them or how they fail at a particular weekend and how they bounce back. But I think overall, this makes sense for him going to Paris and get a few matches. Not sure how this momentum will carry him to the finals because he has to play Novak in the semis if they both get there. And I don't think Federer is playing right now at the level where, you know, of course, you never say never because he's a champion, but I think Djokovic is the man to beat if that match happens. But overall, I do see this as a positive move. And some people are saying this could be the last time in France. I don't want to speculate those things, but I think purely from momentum and rhythm, this could be, you know, beneficial because he hasn't played those many matches compared to last year.
Yeah, well, you know, so, you know, for our listeners tuning in, you know, this is a weekly podcast. And as you said in our open, you know, that this was recorded, we're recording this Sunday evening. So we don't know where we're going to be for the listeners tuning in on either Wednesday or Thursday or Friday. We don't know what's going to happen. I would simply say that a few weeks ago at tennisaccent.com, and we want to make sure that listeners go to our website for written content. We put out stuff every single day. A few weeks ago, after Shanghai, Mert Ertunga and Andrew Burton joined me in a round table, and we all offered some slightly overlapping but largely different thoughts about Federer's schedule for 2019 and what the priorities and points of emphasis should be. And so just in talking about Bercy, not in a specific level, you've done that quite well, but kind of on a larger, more conceptual level, you know, Federer just needs to decide what he wants from his remaining years on tour, however many of them are. You know, does he want to break that Connors match win record? You know, if he does, then playing a few extra 500s, as he did with Rotterdam earlier this year, you know, that would enter into the equation. You know, you can pick up three or four wins there against a moderately challenging field. You know, so if that's a priority for him, you know, he should consider that. You know, if he wants rankings points in 2019, I think that he should go play Roland Garros. And I think that he can play Roland Garros without even playing Rome as a lead-in. And I say that because best of five set tennis, you can play your way into certain conditions. And I know that, you know, that the movements on clay are a problem. And Pierre Paganini, his longtime trainer, you know, has talked about that as why he hasn't played Roland Garros the past few years. But let's say that Federer, you know, tries to play a net rushing game. You know, John McEnroe made the 1984 Roland Garros finals, you know, playing his serve and volley game on red clay. He didn't really care about the conditions. He was going to play his style of game. What if Federer did that, you know, not playing long points at all, you know, insisting on coming to net? I mean, that's what Tennis with an Accent contributor Nick Nemeroff says, that you should get to the net as much as possible on clay because the slowness of the surface gives you time on your approaches. You know, so what if Federer experimented with a net rushing game at Roland Garros? He could probably bluff his way to a couple of five set wins. And if he gets a good draw, no, he wouldn't win the tournament. He wouldn't even come particularly close to winning. But if he made the fourth round, you know, that is a 180 point pickup, and it would please a heck of a lot of tennis fans. And it, you know, assuming that he's playing really short points, you know, it would not leave him physically compromised for the grass season. You know, let's say Federer loses in the fourth round of Roland Garros. So he plays one of the 2 weeks in Paris. That leaves him with a week and a half before his first match in Stuttgart at the start of the grass season. You know, the Stuttgart wouldn't start until Wednesday or Thursday. Federer would have to play only four matches there. You know, it's a 28-player tournament. He would get a first-round bye. So he'd have a week and a half in between matches. He'd have a week, you know, between Paris and Stuttgart in terms of, you know, going over to Germany to set up shop for that tournament. So there are a lot of different considerations for Federer to make in 2019 and if he chooses beyond in terms of how he arranges his schedule. And that's something that constantly fascinates me. And it's something I'm going to definitely be writing about later this week in Bercy, regardless of whether Federer has in fact chosen to stay in that tournament or pull out. So it's a really fascinating ongoing debate.
Okay, so let's shift our focus, Matt. I think you covered Federer plenty well there, and giving even some speculation on, you know, how you would want to see his 2019 campaign unfold. And I'm with you. I think Roland Garros should be part of his schedule if he thinks that's not going to be too taxing on his knees. But let's talk about the man who was at the wrong end of this final, Marius Copil. I don't know if you remember, earlier in the year, one of our good friends, Laura, who's a big Roger Federer fan, came on the podcast, and she jokingly called Copil as the Romanian Federer. And I hadn't seen Copil much. But then I started following, you know, wherever I could get a glimpse. All I knew, he had a monster serve and a one-hand backhand. And I could be very off. I don't know what you saw or what Andrew or Susie saw, but I think purely on the aesthetics of how, you know, the shots are hit, I see more resemblance in Copil's game with Federer than, you know, people make for Dimitrov. The serves are a little different. I got to see Copil at US Open this year when, under brutal conditions, he was serving for the set against Marin Cilic, but then lost that set 7-5. So he's someone, again, you know, it's a classic tennis story. We've been talking about the fall season. You know, some may dismiss as, you know, the people are tired or, you know, mentally fatigued bodies are coming in. And that's why these kind of unknowns are making a run. But to me, this is another narrative, you know, for people, like, players like Copil, Hasse, Milman, and, you know, all the other players like Struff, it's making a living. They all have their professional goals. But no week is a week off. Granted, like, some of the top names like Cilic are fading out right now because, you know, of whatnot issue. Every top player goes through some sort of a lack of form, lack of confidence at this time of the year. In the past, we've seen that. But you cannot shortchange a Copil or a Basilashvili, someone who's making his move up. And this guy coming in Basel was like 10-20 for the year, and he won like five matches or four matches this week. And now the world is witness to, you know, the kind of talent he can produce. Some comparison there for Ljubicic. I really think, you know, the forehand and backhand, there's a lot of comparison with Federer. And I could be wrong. I don't know, Matt, what you saw, but this is, again, a classic tennis story that just emerged from nowhere. But if you have paid attention, he was already knocking the door, played a great match against Andy Murray in Washington, D.C., and then, you know, had glimpses. You know, if you look at, you know, he did make a lot of main draws, but just, like, could not put it together, had a heartbreaking loss to Cecchinato and Roland Garros, I think lost first round 10-8 or 12-10. So this guy was, you know, due for a break. And now, you know, he made it one of the bigger indoor tournaments against, you know, one of the legends of the game.
I'm going to make a few comparisons with Copil. I'm glad you mentioned Nicolaj Basilashvili, not in terms of playing style, but in terms of he can hit the bejesus out of the tennis ball. You know, Basilashvili is just a huge hitter, you know, great ball striker, and Copil, you know, can hit with similarly easy power, but it's always been a question of calibrating the ground strokes such that you know you can replicate them and reliably keep them in the court and hold your nerve in pressure situations. And so Basilashvili, you know, has begun to step forward as someone who has shown he is more capable of replicating the explosive shots in his arsenal. So just solely through that point, not so much stylistic, but in terms of harnessing a big game, that is one comparison. In terms of the serve, I see on serve, just on serve, a resemblance to Cilic. You know, I think that Cilic gets pretty good power and force on his serves. And I think that when I saw Copil throwing down the serves against Zverev and then Federer. I saw a connection to Cilic there. And then I'm going to go 19 years into the history book, Saqib, for this one. I remember the first two sets of the 1999 Roland Garros final when Andre Agassi was absolutely demolished. He was just blown off the court before he came back to win in five sets. Those first two sets with a fairly big guy just sweeping the ball so fluidly and easily down the lines and into the corners, Andre Medvedev, that was the historical comparison I came up with relative to Copil. Just the fluidity of strokes and motions. They recalled Medvedev, not necessarily over the course of a career, but from that specific day in Paris, roughly 19 years ago. So those were some of my observations about Copil. And one more connection, and this is not so much, it's kind of in a vein similar to Basilashvili. Recall how Simone Bolelli crushed the ball against Rafael Nadal at Roland Garros. You know, if Bolelli ever had managed to get a handle on his ground strokes, you know, he would be a top five player. But it is just so hard for dozens of players with incredible ball striking skills to hone and polish their talent. And this week, what we saw, Marius Copil, you know, getting to that point, he got in his zone, and for the most part, he stayed in his zone. You know, he flinched a little bit after he got break leads in each of the two sets he played against Federer, but you know, he was in there all the way. Even when Federer was serving for the match at 5-4 in the second set, Copil played an unreal point to get to 30-30, and then he earned a break point chance, but then Federer threw down a couple money serves, as he has been known to do, but Copil pushed him the whole way. And so he left that tournament never really fading away. You know, he flinched in a few really brief moments, challenge calls that incorrectly. You know, that was really his main manifestation of nerves. But, you know, purely in terms of how he hit the ball throughout that match, he was right there in the hunt. So those are several of the comparisons and thoughts that I have about Copil.
Yeah, and second week in a row, Ernest Gulbis last week in Stockholm and now Marius Copil in Basel, we had a qualifier coming in almost winning, you know, the final. Of course, they both lost in straight sets, but still a mean feat. Let's, you know, talk about Kevin Anderson now before we wrap this podcast up. Matt, correct me if I'm wrong, but I've been very impressed. Even in that match in the Laver Cup, I still think that's the best match of Laver Cup when Anderson beat Djokovic. And then Anderson has shown this steady progress for someone who can really move for that, you know, for his size. And even though Marin Cilic and Juan Martin del Potro are major winners and are both, I think, slightly shorter than Kevin Anderson, I think right now, I believe Kevin Anderson is the best big man in tennis in terms of movement, serve, and the penetration of the ground strokes. And I saw that. I think I mentioned that in the podcast when I was in Miami. I wanted to watch Khachanov, and Khachanov was playing Anderson. I watched the first set. And the day before, I had spoken to Anderson, and Anderson said, if he's playing his best tennis, he believes he's top five. Because my question was, you belong in top 10. He said, no, I think if I'm playing and hitting the ball I want to, I'm top five. And when I saw him handle Khachanov's pace with ease, that just showed me he was like definitely heading in a different direction. You know, he was already in a different class. He was like a top 10 player who on his day can challenge anyone. And we've seen glimpses, you know, his Wimbledon run. And then, you know, he handled Kei Nishikori today. I mean, this is a guy who definitely is very comfortable on most surfaces other than clay. What's your take on his title in Vienna?
Well, I want to ask you something about Anderson, and I'll get to that shortly. But first, in terms of my response, two main thoughts. One is, and you know, not everything revolves around Roger Federer. You know, I think that, you know, our coverage of the tennis tours at our website and also on Twitter, you know, we don't write about every match Federer plays or every match Federer wins. We write about him basically when he gets eliminated from a tournament or when he wins a tournament. You know, we're not covering him all the time. But one point stands out about Anderson's Vienna title relative to Federer. This is Anderson's first ATP 500 title at age 32. And so, you know, some people might say, okay, Federer, you know, swooped in and picked off an easy 500, you know, without Djokovic, without Nadal, you know, without, you know, an elite field. Well, you know, Anderson, with all his talent, finally getting that first 500 at age 32 shows how really darn hard it is to win tournaments in tennis at any level. And so that should just be kind of a reminder about what Federer's 99 titles mean. Even if he's picking off, you know, a couple 500s here or even a 250 in Stuttgart, winning titles is hard. And so Anderson's win over Kei Nishikori, you know, can be appreciated as the significant accomplishment it is. The other main takeaway about Anderson, who's now clinched his first ATP Finals appearance, is that 13 months ago at this time, Saqib, did anyone think that Anderson would be in this position? Did anyone think that he was going to put together this kind of a year with really consistent results? Lots of hard court Masters quarterfinals. Heck, he even made a clay Masters semifinal in Madrid. That was his first Masters semifinal, by the way. Made the Wimbledon final. I mean, he not only destroyed the notion that, you know, his 2017 U.S. Open run was a fluke or an aberration. I mean, he substantially built on that achievement and took his game to a much higher level this year. You know, the 2017 U.S. Open draw, that was a really weak draw, especially when Zverev lost in the second round, and then, you know, that gave Anderson the better path. This year, Anderson was going through tough fields, and of course, he beat Federer at Wimbledon. So this Vienna title is just kind of an exclamation point on a great and historic year and a deserved first appearance in London. I don't think many people in tennis thought that Anderson would be here. So now the question that I was going to ask you, when you compare Anderson to Del Potro, and I know that this is something that Nick Nemeroff, we mentioned him earlier, talked about in our Shanghai preview at the start of October. You know, that was one of the matches Nick and I both, you know, are hopeful that we will see it, like the Australian Open or another really big situation on the tour in 2019. So when you more finally break down an Anderson Delpo comparison, and I know that we're dealing with Delpo's injuries, but if we assume that Delpo is once again able to heal up on is once again able to get, you know, relatively close to the point that he reached at the U.S. Open this past year, what are the more specific things in your mind, Saqib, that would elevate Anderson over Del Potro in a contest? You know, because, you know, they both reached an extremely high level. They both did reach the top five at some point this year. You know, Anderson moved out of the top five only because he was defending all those U.S. Open points, but he got there before the U.S. Open. So really, he and Delpo have been playing on a very similar level this year. So what more particular items do you think elevates Anderson over Delpo in that comparison?
Look, it's a very tricky question. And, you know, I don't want to dodge the question, but I'll take my own path here. I've always believed when I have these kind of conversations, even, you know, the non-podcast platform, and I'm talking with friends or, you know, doing tennis DMs, you know, with friends like you on Twitter. I think you don't beat the field collectively. You beat the man across the net. So tennis is all about matchups. It's an individual sport. That being said, I think Del Potro has one of the biggest weapons in tennis with that forehand. But I'll use a very different criteria here. Right now, the baseline standard of the game is Novak Djokovic. He's, you know, rightfully asserted himself back as the man to beat, and the way he's playing, I'm going to judge, you know, most players next year, because if Djokovic doesn't, his level doesn't come down, I'm thinking he's going to be a factor in every tournament he enters. And just purely on that regard, and again, a lot of people will dismiss the notion that I'm going to keep using the Laver Cup match, because that match was serious. Not that Anderson, you know, can repeat that against Djokovic, but in terms of movement, in terms of staying, the ability to stay with Novak, not many people can stay with Novak. Even Juan Martin has beaten Novak Djokovic in 2016 in some, you know, some key matches, and they have a great rivalry. But the U.S. Open final was pretty one-sided. Again, you don't want to compare US Open with Laver Cup, so I'm going the disclaimer again. But just purely on the mechanics, how Anderson was able to stay in baseline rallies with, you know, the great Novak Djokovic, I think to me there is more upside. Of course, the next time they play, Djokovic can kill him 2 and 3. But what I learned from that match, and that gives me, you know, some sort of a belief for Kevin Anderson that he can play with the best. And I think a lot has to go right for Novak to compete with, a lot has to go right for Del Potro to compete on a baseline slugfest with Novak, because Novak's movement and the way Novak can neutralize Del Potro's big, you know, thunderous ground strokes and find his backhand, which is usually a slice backhand in longer matches. I don't know if I'm answering your question. Again, you have to beat the field, but if you're going to go by the standard, the player who is, you know, sitting at the top in terms of like total baseline quality, I know Nadal's number one right now, but, you know, let's not go away from the fact that Djokovic will be a favorite in most matches going forward till something else changes in men's game. So I don't know if I'm answering your question, Matt, but I think if at business ends, there is a match between these top players, I like Anderson to challenge Djokovic more than I see Del Potro. I don't know if I'm answering your question, but then they have to beat so many other players. There's Federer in the mix, there's Zverev in the mix, there's Dominic Thiem in the mix. Of course, matchups would dictate who plays who on a given surface, but the absolute baseline standard is Novak Djokovic right now, and I think Kevin Anderson has a more complete game, and that, of course, you know, it sets off that with that big serve. Then I think he can, he's definitely, his baseline game is underrated. He can stay with the best. That's what I'm trying to say.
No, and I think you said it well. And, you know, you said at the beginning of your answer, you know, you're going to follow your own path. That is the only way any of us can answer questions from our viewpoint, the way we see it, the way we process it. That's a perfectly good answer and a perfectly good way to wrap up our podcast. I want to tell our listeners that you can find Saqib on Twitter at S-A-Q-I-B-A. Saqiba, basically, the shorthand. And you can follow me on Twitter at M as in Matthew, my first name, Zemek, Z-E-M as in Michael, E-K. Follow me at M Zemek for my tweets. And our tennis with an accent Twitter handle is accent_tennis, where we retweet some of Saqib's tweets, some of my tweets, and some other tweets from the ATP Tour feed and other tennis feeds around the world. And we want to invite you to interact with us. You know, we're coming up. The off season's not too far away, and we're, you know, trying to plan our December content menu. And if you have ideas or suggestions for some of the things that you'd like to see at our website, tennisaccent.com, which we encourage you to visit, please let us know on Twitter. Go get into our mentions, and we'll be happy to consider various ideas you have. And we want to be able to interact with you also about the stories that you read at our website so that we can continue to serve you as readers. I would also like to remind you, in concluding this podcast, this is produced by Radio Influence, and you can hear us courtesy of Radio Influence at radioinfluence.com, also at Google Play, Stitcher, and especially iTunes and Apple Podcasts, where we encourage you to subscribe, rate, and review. So, for my co-host Saqib Ali, this is Matt Zemek signing off on this week's edition of the Tennis with an Accent podcast. We'll see you next week.
Bye for now.
This is a Crush Performance Quick Fix on Radio Influence.
The NCAA generates massive amounts of money with little or no expenditure because they don't have to pay the players. So, for example, the NBA last year, the NBA generated $7.4 billion of revenue. Major League Baseball, for the first time, broke $10 billion. The NFL, I think they're well over $11 million. And the goal for the NFL by 2026 is they want to break $26 billion in revenue. How they're going to do it, I don't know. Ticket prices are already expensive. That only goes so far. But if I were to ask you, and again, I asked you earlier, if you knew how much revenue the NCAA generated last year, would you take a guess at that?
Well, basketball alone would be massive. So when you factor in football, you factor in all the bowl games, that's going to be a really big number. Like, that's going to be... That will be right up there at the major leagues, if not more, because of all the leagues that it covers, all the sports it covers.
Yeah, you'd think so. So if anybody out there is by their phone or their Googles, as long as you're not driving, just Google NCAA revenue 2017. $1 billion. For the first time ever, they just broke $1 billion in revenue. Now, we've got to get a forensic accountant in there to break this down, because I believe, I'm with you, I couldn't believe the number was so low. But even at $1 billion, without the players earning a cent, that is concerning. So, you know, there's a lot of talk about what's going on in the NCAA and players not getting played. You have talk about just the environment of the players working for free, only getting a salary cap. Here's my take on it. Pay the players. And pay them whatever you want.
Crush Performance with Jeff Crushell can be found on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Play, and RadioInfluence.com.